conditions on the roads and pavements. Most will stay dry and bright, but increasing chance of showers later, particularly towards the eastern coast. Temperatures ranging from 2 in Newcastle to 7 in the likes of Manchester. But for Wales, the Midlands, South East and South West England, ice and fog patches forming through the night. And then tomorrow, some brighter conditions giving way to some heavy showers with thunder and hail, a high of around 9.
All right, many thanks, Matt Taylor, with the weather. Time now for a new book of the week. In the World Until Yesterday, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jared Diamond draws upon his decades of experience living and working in Papua New Guinea to ask, what can traditional societies teach us about how we in the West live now? The reader is Crawford Logan.
April the 30th, 2006, 7 a.m. I'm in an airport's check-in hall, gripping my luggage trolley while being jostled by a crowd of other people also checking in for that morning's first flights. The airport at which I'm checking in is that of Port Moresby, capital of Papua New Guinea. To anyone with a sense of New Guinea's history, including me, who first came to Papua New Guinea in the 60s when it was still administered by Australia, the scene is at once familiar, astonishing, and moving. I find myself mentally comparing the scene with the photographs taken by the first Australians to enter and discover New Guinea's highlands in 1931, teeming with a million New Guinea villagers still then using stone tools. In those photographs, the highlanders, who had been living for millennia in relative isolation with limited knowledge of an outside world, stare in horror at their first sight of Europeans. Within a generation or two, and within the individual lives of many people in that airport hall, New Guinea highlanders learned to write, use computers, and fly airplanes. Some of the people in the hall might actually have been the first people in their tribe to have learned reading and writing. That generation gap was symbolized for me by the image of two New Guinea men in the airport crowd, the younger leading the older. The younger in a pilot's uniform, explaining to me that he was taking the older one, his grandfather, for the old man's first flight in an airplane. And the grey-haired grandfather looking almost as bewildered and overwhelmed as the people in the 1931 photos. An observer familiar with New Guinea history would have recognised bigger differences between the 1931 and 2006 scenes beyond the fact that people wore grass skirts then and Western garb now. New Guinea highland societies in 1931 lacked not just manufactured clothing, but also all modern technologies. More fundamentally, the New Guinea highlands of 1931 lacked writing, metal, money, schools, and centralized government. They would also have noted that the modern scene contained a higher proportion of grey-haired old people, relatively fewer of whom survived in traditional highland society. Another subtle difference was that the 2006 crowd included some New Guineans with an unfortunately common Western body type, overweight people with beer bellies hanging over their belts. The photos of 75 years ago show not even a single overweight New Guinean. Everybody was lean and muscular. Still another distinction was a feature that we take for granted in the modern world. Most of the people crammed into that airport hall were strangers who had never seen each other before, but there was no fighting going on among them. That would have been unimaginable in 1931, when encounters with strangers were rare, dangerous, and likely to turn violent. In the last 75 years, the New Guinea highland population has raced through changes that took thousands of years to unfold in much of the rest of the world. For individual highlanders, the changes have been even quicker. Some of my New Guinea friends have told me of making the last stone axes and participating in the last traditional tribal battles a mere decade before I met them. Today, citizens of industrial states take for granted the features of the 2006 scene that I mentioned. Metal, writing, airplanes, police and government, overweight people, meeting strangers without fear, heterogeneous populations, and so on. But all those features of modern human societies are relatively new in human history. For most of the 6 million years since the proto-human and proto-chimpanzee evolutionary lines diverged from each other, all human societies lacked metal and all those other things. The shift from hunter-gathering to farming began only about 11,000 years ago. The first metal tools were produced only about 7,000 years ago. And the first state government and the first writing arose only around 5,400 years ago. Modern conditions have prevailed, even just locally, for only a tiny fraction of human history. All human societies have been traditional for far longer than any society has been modern. Thus, New Guinea is in some respects a window onto the human world as it was until a mere yesterday, measured against a timescale of the 6 million years of human evolution. Why do we find traditional societies so fascinating? Partly it's because of their human interest. The fascination of getting to know people who are so similar to us and understandable in some ways, and so unlike us and hard to understand in other ways. Traditional lifestyles are what shaped us and caused us to be what we are now. Today, we take for granted farm-grown and store-bought food rather than wild food hunted and gathered daily, tools of metal rather than of stone and wood and bone, state government and its associated law courts and police and armies, and reading and writing. But all of those seeming necessities are relatively new. Traditional societies are far more diverse in many of their cultural practices than our modern industrial societies. For example, compared to any modern industrial society, some traditional societies treat elderly people much more cruelly, while others offer elderly people much more satisfying lives. While social scientists can draw conclusions of academic interest from studies of traditional societies, all the rest of us may also be able to learn things of practical interest. Traditional societies, in effect, represent thousands of natural experiments in how to construct a human society. They have come up with thousands of solutions to human problems, solutions different from those adopted by our own modern societies. Some of those solutions, for instance, some of the ways in which traditional societies raise their children, treat their elderly, remain healthy, talk, spend their leisure time, and settle disputes, may strike you, as they do me, as superior to normal practices in the first world. Perhaps we could benefit by selectively adopting some of those traditional practices. Some of us already do so, with demonstrated benefits to our health and happiness. In some respects, we moderns are misfits. Our bodies and our practices now face conditions different from those under which they evolved and to which they became adapted. But we should also not go to the opposite extreme of romanticizing the past and longing for simpler times. Many traditional practices are ones that we can consider ourselves blessed to have discarded, such as infanticide, abandoning or killing elderly people, facing periodic risk of starvation, being at heightened risk from environmental dangers and infectious diseases, often seeing one's children die and living in constant fear of being attacked. Traditional societies may not only suggest to us some better living practices, but may also help us appreciate some advantages of our own society that we take for granted. Most modern nations have populations of hundreds of thousands or millions of people, ranging up to over 1 billion people each for India and China, the two most populous modern nations. No hunter-gatherer society has ever been able to feed a sufficiently dense population to support a state government. Before 3400 BC, there were no states anywhere, and in recent times there have still been large areas beyond state control operating under traditional, simpler political systems. The smallest and simplest type of society consists of just a few dozen individuals, many of them belonging to one or several extended families. Most nomadic hunter-gatherers traditionally lived at low population densities in such small groups. Everyone knows everyone else well, group decisions can be reached by face-to-face discussion, and there is no formal political leadership or strong economic specialisation. Members differ little in wealth, there are few personal possessions anyway, and in political power, except as a result of individual differences in ability or personality, and as tempered by extensive sharing of resources among band members. If social scientists equipped with a time machine could have surveyed the world at any time before about 9000 BC, they would have found everybody, everywhere, subsisting as hunter-gatherers, living without centralized government or economic specialization. If those social scientists could have returned in the 1400s, at the time when the expansion of Europeans to other continents was just beginning, they now would have found Australia to be the sole continent still occupied entirely by hunter-gatherers. Why, as of the year of Columbus's first transatlantic voyage of 1492, did people live in different types of societies in different parts of the world? At that time, some peoples, especially Eurasians, were already living under state governments, while Aboriginal Australians still preserved many ways of life that had characterized all of the world until 9000 BC. The explanation depends partly on environmental differences. Increases in political centralization and social stratification were driven by increases in human population densities, driven in turn by the rise and intensification of food production, agriculture and herding. But surprisingly few wild plant and animal species are suitable for domestication to become crops and livestock. Those few wild species were concentrated in only about a dozen small areas of the world, whose human societies consequently enjoyed a decisive head start in developing food production, food surpluses, expanding populations, advanced technology, and state government. Those differences explain why Europeans, living near the world region, the Fertile Crescent, with the most valuable domesticable wild plant and animal species, ended up expanding over the world, while the Aboriginal Australians did not. Much of the world until yesterday lives on in our bodies and in our societies. But for those of us who have grown up in modern state societies, modern conditions of life are so pervasive and so taken for granted that it's hard for us to notice the fundamental differences of traditional societies during short visits to them. Traditional societies represent thousands of millennia-long natural experiments in organizing human lives. We can't repeat those experiments by redesigning thousands of societies today in order to wait decades and observe the outcomes. We have to learn from the societies that already ran the experiments. Traditional societies of the past, and those that survived into modern times, behaved like tiny nations. They maintained their own territories or core areas, visited and received visitors from some but not other nations, and in some cases delineated, defended, and patrolled boundaries as rigorously as do modern nations. They were far more restricted in their knowledge of the outside world. They divided other peoples more sharply into friends, enemies, and strangers than does even North Korea today. In the next episode, we shall discover how these tiny traditional nations maintained peace and how they made war.
Crawford Logan was reading The World Until Yesterday by Jared Diamond. The book is abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Here's sailing by to take us up to the shipping forecast. Now, on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday, the 19th of March. There are warnings of gales in South Otsera, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, Southern England 990, losing its identity. New low expected Plymouth 995 by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Otsera, easterly 5 to 7 at first in South Viking, otherwise mainly southeasterly 4 or 5. Wintry showers, good, occasionally poor. South Otsera, Forties, Cromarty, Forth.